Let's play some cards.
From Harrah's St. Louis Casino and Hotel, this is The Final Table, starring professional poker player Dennis Phillips and Paul Harrah's.
Winner, winner, chicken dinner!
Wow, winning.
Now, from the Harrah's St. Louis Poker Room, here are Dennis and Paul on 590 The Fan, KFNS, and KFNS.com.
Just a few hours ago, the Bad Beat jackpot was hit here at Harrah's St. Louis. A guy with quad sixes got it all in against the guy who was drawn to a straight and a flush and hit it. A seven high spade straight flush, best hand, quad sixes, second best hand, $20,000 in the jackpot. So the quad sixes made 10 grand. This was in a 3-6 limit game. Anytime you can play 3-6 limit and make $10,000, you can pretty much chalk that up as the greatest day in your poker life. That just happened a few hours ago here in the Harrah's St. Louis World Series of Poker Room. That's where I am. I am Paul Harrah's. My partner, Dennis Phillips, laughing at the other end, is at home in Las Vegas. How about that for a return in a 3-6 game where the buy-in is usually, like $100, $70, $80, something like that?
Yeah, most people just sit down there to kill a few hours, socialize, have some fun, and then you leave the table with $10,000. Not bad at all.
Well, it's like last March when I was out there for you playing in the NBC Heads Up, and the night before I went into the Caesars Palace Poker Room and sat down with a bunch of poker pros and a bunch of other poker media people. Eric Morris from Bluff was there, and Donnie Peters from Poker News, and Chris Moneymaker, Jason Mercier, Joe Hashem, Jason Alexander, they were all there. And I ended up in a bad beat hand with Eric Morris. And, it was a 1-3 game, and I ended up making a couple of grand, which, again, not the kind of return you expect in a low-limit game like that. So these guys, I'm sure, were out of their mind with excitement this morning. And it's been a while since it's been hit in a 3-6 game. Usually it's hit in a 1-2 no-limit game. So congratulations to them.
Absolutely. I actually was at Caesars yesterday, and last night their bad beat was hit with quads over, or straight flush over quads. I think theirs was only a little over 10,000, but there were some very happy people in the poker room last night there, too.
Absolutely. All right. Before we get into anything else, we should mention that we were planning on having a guest on today's show, Will the Thrill, Will Fela. We were hoping to be able to get him in here today in between his victories at Borgata, but Dennis told me just moments before he went on the air, Will can't do the show because he's still running deep in the main event there.
Will has been having quite a series there. The first event had over 1,900 people in it. He won it for about 165,000, I think. He has final tabled three more events since then. And now he's running deeper down to, last 100 or so in the main event, and he's got above chip average. And he said, sorry, Dennis, I'm going to go win some money.
I don't understand why you wouldn't want to take an hour away from the table or a half hour away from the table to interrupt your run to talk to us. I don't get it, Will.
Let me tell you, Will is one of those guys that makes it fun to play poker.
Yeah,
I've known him for a number of years now. We've sat at tables. We've competed against each other. He likes to do the sit and goes at the WSOP like I like to do those. And Will is just flamboyant and gregarious and entertaining. And you better not sit down there with a frown on your face or he will just rip you apart. He's so much fun.
Well, we're going to
love playing with him.
We're going to reschedule Will and have him on. Well, we can't have him on next week because David Bach is going to be on the show with us. David just back from winning a big event down at the Aussie Millions. He spent a couple of weeks down under and took down a $2,500, PLO event down there. Oh, no, it was a mixed game event. So he'll be on with us next week. And then in a couple of weeks, we're finally going to talk to the man who started off the year in a very Seidel-like manner. That's Jonathan Duhamel, the 2010 World Series of Poker main event winner. He'll be on with us in a couple of weeks. So maybe Will can come on with us in like 3 weeks. Can we plan that far ahead? Is that possible in the poker world to plan 3 weeks ahead?
Well, we hopefully can, and I'm sure Will will want to be on. Like I said, he's a really good guy. I think his biggest win was the Legends of Poker, that WPT event that he won for like $750,000 or something like that. But yeah. The last 2 years, he's done very, very well.
Good for him. So he'll have some stories to share, and we'll catch up with him sometime in February. The other big news here in St. Louis, aside from the bad beat being hit this morning, is the big game, which was in town this weekend. We had a couple of tables, I think a total of 17 or 18 players involved in the $15,000 buy-in, $25.50 no-limit game with a $10 ante. Also had a couple of tables of 10-20 no-limit, which went fairly strong. Your buddy Nelly showed up here late on Saturday night and played in that for several hours. I'm sure the people in the blackjack pit here were not happy to see Nelly in the cash game in the poker room, but all the poker players were happy to have him here. Nelly has played on and off for, I don't know, about 4 or 5 years, both in No Limit Hold'em and in Pot Limit Omaha, and I didn't get a report on how things went on Saturday. I wasn't here because I had a horrible Friday night and just wasn't feeling well the rest of the weekend, so didn't come back for the rest of the big game. But congratulations to all the people who did come and make some money in that. And hopefully we'll get a chance to do that again. And next time, we'll plan it out so that it's not on your girlfriend's birthday weekend.
That would be nice. I decided I had better pass on it this time. So well, sorry about that.
You know what? We talk a lot about equity in poker, fold equity and that sort of thing. There's also something called home equity. I don't mean getting a loan so that you can refinance your house or build a new deck. I mean the equity you have with your partner in your life, whether it's your girlfriend or your wife or your husband or whoever it is, that allows you to go out and play. Recreational players know this phrase very well. Well, let's see. I went away to Commerce for the weekend. I don't think I'm going to be playing two nights after we get back. I've got to build up the home equity before I'm allowed out of the house to play a little bit. If you had not been there for your girlfriend's birthday weekend, if you decided to come here, even if you had brought her along and said, I'm going to be playing poker in the big game all weekend long, you kill your home equity for like a month or more, right?
Absolutely, you do. It wouldn't make any difference. I mean, I would have to kill the game. No, that wouldn't even do it either. Never mind. There's no way I would win on this.
I don't care. I don't care how much you run over the table. If it's her birthday and she has to sit around while you play poker, you cannot win. It doesn't matter. You could get a ring. You could do anything else. It is not going to work out. I speak as a man who's been married for 28 plus years. You got to watch that home equity meter and make sure you read it right.
All right, cool.
All right, so before we get into other poker-related news, let's talk about the other big event that's coming up in the next few days, and that, of course, is Super Bowl 46 on Sunday. You know, the Rams are nowhere close to being in this thing. I don't think they're even allowed to get tickets after the season they had.
Okay.
it's not a big story here any bigger than it is elsewhere, but it is the New York Giants and the New England Patriots, a replay of 08. And the reason I bring it up is because I saw a story that said that the sports books out in Las Vegas think that they might break the record with the amount of money wagered on the Super Bowl. The record was held in 2006 when the Steelers and the Seahawks played. That was $94 million bet in the Las Vegas sports books. Now, I'm sure you'll be playing poker at some point this weekend. Is that a crazy weekend to be around anywhere with all these people coming in to watch the Super Bowl and play? Is that a good poker environment?
Oh, it's a very, very good poker environment. There's several times that you want to be around the rest of the crowd. This is one of them. March Madness is another one. The All-Star Game is another one. These guys come in here. They're going to have a fun weekend. They're going to watch the Super Bowl. And they're going to have to do something before, during, and after. And some of them will be sitting at a poker table. And some of them that will be sitting there are not used to sitting at a poker table. And some of them that are sitting there are more interested in the TV than the poker that's going on.
Yep.
And you kind of like all of those situations.
Absolutely. Particularly people who've come in, they obviously have cash in their pocket. And if you can get some of it from them before the sports books do on Sunday, that's a nice opportunity.
It is. It's a great time to play here. And it's a fun time. They're in here to have fun and to watch the Super Bowl and enjoy life. And if they lose a little bit, they don't care. If they win a little bit, they enjoy it. It's just a fun time. It's a good time to sit around the tables.
Now, normally when you talk about sports books or even illegal bookies, the way they make their money is off the vig, the juice. You know, they're charging you 10% just to put the bet down, and if they can get bets on both sides, they make the 10% regardless of which team wins. So that's how they get rich. However, there's an interesting scenario with this Sunday's game because of the Giants and a futures bet back during the middle of the season. At one point in the season when the Giants were 6-6, the odds on them winning the Super Bowl were 80-1. Now, of course, as the season closed out and the Giants went on that run that got them into the playoffs and then winning, obviously, the last couple of weeks to get to the Super Bowl, those numbers shortened considerably. But if you put down that money at 80-1 when they were 6-6, you could have a very nice return. I'm reminded of the St. Louisan, who in 1999 went to the Stardust Sportsbook and put $10,000 down on the Rams to win the Super Bowl before Kurt Warner's name had ever been mentioned. Trent Green was still the quarterback of the Rams at the time. This guy put down 10 grand at 200-1. Trent Green got injured a week later. This unknown guy named Kurt Warner stepped up and took the Rams all the way, and that guy collected a $2 million payday. Now, I don't know if anybody's put down a 10K bet on the Giants when it was 80-1, but you know that whichever books did take action on that at that point are sweating it a little bit this weekend.
Oh, it's always a little something like that. Actually, last summer, at the end of August, there were some people that put bets down on the Cardinals to win the World Series. And the odds they got there, phenomenal. I have heard stories of people putting down $100 bets and winning $160,000 and that type of a thing. So every year there's these long shots, of which 99 out of 100 never materialize, of course.
Right.
But, you know, who knows? The Giants could make somebody's retirement.
Yep.
Is what they could end up doing.
So
awesome.
You know the sports books, at least those that took the action on that futures bet, they're really going to be in the Patriots' corner come Sunday.
go Tom Brady.
Now, I also did some looking around at football prop bets, which is what the books also do, because they're not just going to put up the regular line for the game, which is now settled in around 3 points. The Pats are favored by 3. But they also have some other football prop bets. Like, you can bet on who will be the MVP of the game. Tom Brady's the favorite, then Eli Manning, Victor Cruz of the Giants, Rob Gronkowski of the Patriots. Those are your top four there. Then you can also bet on things like this. Will New York or Boston have a higher local TV rating for the Super Bowl? What's the exact number of TD passes Eli Manning will throw? What's the exact number of TD passes Tom Brady will throw? And different odds for each one of those. Total passing yards for each quarterback. Number of receptions by each person. Who will score the first touchdown of the game? Rob Gronkowski, the Patriots tight end, is the favorite, followed by Aaron Hernandez and Victor Cruz of the Patriots and Victor Cruz of the Giants. Then they get into the cross sports props. Eli Manning completions versus LeBron James points, because the Heat are playing on Sunday. Wes Welker receptions against LeBron James assists. Hakeem Nicks receptions against total goals in the Flyers-Rangers NHL game on Sunday. Eli Manning TD passes versus Tim Hardaway Jr. three-point shots made in the game. And then they go even further than that. Some of these books have put up hundreds of these prop bets. I'm not making these up. How long will it take Kelly Clarkson to sing the national anthem? What will she wear to sing the national anthem? Will she forget or omit at least one word of the official U.S. national anthem? Will her bare belly be showing when she sings the national anthem? What color will Madonna's hair be when she begins the Super Bowl halftime show? Will she wear a hat? How many times will Gisele Bündchen, that's Tom Brady's girlfriend, how many times will she be shown on TV during the game? Oh, they're married. I'm sorry, wife. How many times will David Tyree's 2008 Super Bowl catch be shown on TV during the game? How many times will Andrew Luck be mentioned during the game? If Tom Brady's son is shown on TV during the game, will he be wearing a Tom Brady jersey? I think that one's a lock.
Yeah.
I don't know. Go ahead.
This is crazy. This is so crazy. I mean, my mind goes to where were these people sitting when they thought up these prop bets? And how many rounds had they had?
Well, yeah, I know a guy by the name of Bob Scucci who for years ran the Stardust Sportsbook, which was always the first to come out with the lines on Sunday nights as soon as the last NFL game ended. They had the games for the next week, and they kind of set the standard there. And he used to tell me that for Super Bowl Sunday, as soon as the NFC and AFC championship games were over, he and his crew would go to this little sushi restaurant in the back of the Stardust, and he told everybody, bring a legal pad and write down anything you can think of, and we will see if it's possible. We'll set a line, and we will put it up. And they would put out five or six typewritten sheets of these prop bets. One of the prop, and that's what all the other sports books do now, but Bob and his crew were amongst the first to do that. One of them is, what color will the Gatorade that's dumped on the head coach of the winning Super Bowl team be? I mean, I think it comes down to what, green or orange? Are there other colors of Gatorade, or is there blue? I don't know. But all of these wacky prop bets are going to be available. And you know what? Bob told me that it didn't matter how many bets they put up, every single bet they put up got at least one person betting on it. Every single one. You could bet on the coin toss. Everything else gets action. Unbelievable.
Well, yeah, some of them are a little far-fetched, but you can see where they come from. Will there be a safety score? You know, things like that that probably aren't going to happen, but, you know, whatever. But, Tom, you know, what are they going to have next? Is Tom Brady going to hoist his son on his left or right shoulder?
That might be in here. I didn't go through all 500, but it could be in there. So,
if not, I may have given him an idea.
Do you and I want to have a little bet here on the game?
We could, absolutely.
Which team do you like? It's the Patriots minus three.
Well, I actually would take the Giants in 3 points.
All right, I'll take the Patriots.
Yeah, I think it's a fairly close game. I really do. But I like what they've done the last couple of months. I like how positive they are. And they are the underdog. And you always got to root for the underdog. So, you know, I would go with that.
All right.
What do you want to make for a bet? Got to make it something, but, you know, something easy.
$100.
Oh, I was gonna say a meal out for you and your significant other.
Okay.
Or something like that.
I think that
maybe we can go to the new one.
Knowing the bottles of wine that you order, that's going to cost me more than $100. But okay. But that's fine. This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show. I'm Paul Harris at the World Series of Poker Room in Harris, St. Louis. And my partner Dennis Phillips is out there in Las Vegas. A reminder that we're available via iTunes. Our podcasts are downloadable that way. And also via Stitcher Radio. If you don't have an iPhone or an iPad, you can get us on all the other smart devices that are out there via Stitcher Radio. Okay, let's talk about some poker here. One of the big stories of the last week has to do with Chris Jesus Ferguson, who has turned into one of the villains of the post-Black Friday environment because he and Howard Lederer and Ray Bittar are the three chief guys who were indicted in the indictments against Full Tilt Poker. And now there's a new story that came out this week from Subject Poker, Noah Estes' site, in which he says that Chris Jesus Ferguson is holding up any further movement over the Group Bernard Tepe Full Tilt Poker deal because of money that he took from Full Tilt Poker and then loaned back to the company, something like $14.3 million, which he now is saying he wants the company to pay back to him, that apparently he has sued Full Tilt and won't allow anything to go forward until he gets his $14 million back. He says that he allowed that money to go back into the Full Tilt's accounts to take care of expenditures by the company post-Black Friday. That's according to the report in Subject Poker. Now, I'm not sure I understand all of these developments, but today we got a response from Chris Ferguson's attorney, a guy by the name of Ian Imrich, which looks like I am rich when you spell it out. He says that the reporting that was in Subject Poker was full of lots of erroneous comments and contentions. He says that the money that Chris is seeking to recover was used for the company's expenses after Black Friday, and that legal threats are being made that could delay the Bernard Tapie deal. But Imrich said that Ferguson is seeking mostly an accounting of Ray Bitar's funds. He says, and the DOJ said, it got at least $41 million from his work with Full Tilt, and they want to find out exactly what happened to that money and where it went. So this seems to be an internal battle between the guys who were among the directors of Full Tilt Poker. But when you go back to the story that we heard for months about Full Tilt not paying back its players because it was, quote, out of money, and then we found out that these guys gave themselves compensation to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars, none of this looks good for the poker players who are still owed money by Full Tilt, right?
You're right. And there's a lot more information that is yet to be kind of filtered out, shall we say. According to the records, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, the total compensation for Chris Ferguson was in the tune of about $85 million. And that's from about 07 on. So he was getting anywhere from $1.3 to $1.9 million a month in compensation back from these guys.
Yep.
Now then, $25 million of that was paid directly into his personal account, easily traceable in the rest of it. The other $60 million that, first of all, on the indictment was characterized as owed to him, which didn't make any sense. We actually commented on that when it first came out on Black Friday. Why would they still owe Chris $60 million? What's going on here? Actually went into a series of other accounts. And out of those accounts, Chris pulled about $45 million of it out for various things. He bought some shares from somebody else, made loans to other players, a whole variety of different things. There's $14.3 that was supposedly still in the accounts that after Black Friday, Chris gave them the right to use that to cover short-term expenses while this is getting sorted out. Now, according to what I've been reading and hearing, what Chris is asking for is, number one, where did you spend my $14 million that I allowed you to do? And number two, where did the money that Ray Bitar got, the $41 million, go? And you know, was there some not ethical usage of funds and everything there and that he wants to find out? If that's what the case is, this actually should not be holding up the agreement between the DOJ and Bernard Tapie. What I find very, very curious, though, is that the DOJ has yet to even come out and acknowledge that a deal is close to being completed.
Right.
You hear everything from the attorneys. The DOJ is, unfortunately, extremely quiet about this.
Yep.
So I think there's more shoes to fall.
The question,
I don't know.
The question is, when you talk about Full Tilt Poker owing Chris Ferguson $14 million, is does Chris Ferguson go to the head of the line of creditors, and do you put him ahead of all of the people who put money on Full Tilt Poker, which then fused its player money and its corporate money, commingled those funds so that they were paying themselves out of money that belonged to the players? When you talk about the $85 million that was paid to Chris Ferguson, or the $20 million that was paid to Howard Lederer, or whatever the numbers are, that money wasn't just out of profits of Full Tilt Poker. Much of it was out of player funds. We still don't know exactly how that happened or why, but does Chris Ferguson go ahead of the Full Tilt players whose money has now been lost in those accounts? Shouldn't they be the ones who go first to get their money back before a guy who already got $60 million does?
Well, again, several things here to clarify. we don't know exactly what funds and what accounts and how much money was in the accounts. I've heard $98 million in this account. I've heard $130 million in this account. We don't know what funds the DOJ has seized and how they're going to use them. We don't know because, again, the silence from the DOJ, the $80 million that they're supposedly paying to the DOJ, is that money going to be used to refund back to the players? Do they have the funds to pay back this $150 million that's owed to the U.S. players or not? Are they seizing funds because of the activities and are going to be fining Chris Ferguson and Howard Lederer and such? I mean, there's so many questions out here. But to come back to the basics of it, the legality of it, underneath their charter, underneath where they were operating, it appears it was not illegal for them to use those players' funds. Was it unethical? Was it improper? Was it poor business practice? What, were they being idiots by doing it? I can answer yes to all of those. But was it illegal?
Well,
and I'm not for sure it was illegal for them to take that money and pay it out as, you know, whatever you want to call it, a salary or owner share or royalties or whatever.
Well, I would see it as being illegal if it were fraud. And if you are taking money from people under one pretense and saying you're going to hold it for them in a secure account, and then you're not keeping it for them in a secure account because you're paying yourself from those accounts, then that would be fraud. And that's one of the things that will have to be answered when the DOJ finally does come forward and make its case before a grand jury, or because there are indictments, there's already been a grand jury. If this thing ever actually goes to trial, that's the case that Parit Bharara and the Southern District of New York U.S. Attorney's Office will have to make.
And the bottom line on this, and I think you and I, well, I know you and I both agree on this, is some way, shape, or form, somehow or other, that $150 million that's owed to U.S. players has to be repaid. I don't care whether it comes from Chris Ferguson selling his hat to the DOJ selling the company to whatever. Some way, somebody's got to find a way to pay these players back. That's the proper thing to do, whether it's legal, whether it's whatever, where it comes from. I don't really give a dang. They should come at the head of the line, and they should get their money back some way, shape, or form.
Right, that's my point. When you make a list of creditors, put the players first. Put the players first. Now, in a related story, Bloomberg News is reporting this afternoon that units of Full Tilt Poker and 10 executives have just won dismissal of civil claims filed under the Federal RICO Act, the Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act. The Bloomberg story says, quote, the lawsuit filed in June by Full Tilt Poker players seeking to recoup as a group about $150 million they claim they lost when Full Tilt Poker and others were like it were shut down by the DOJ. Federal prosecutors accused the sites in criminal cases of violating laws barring online gambling. According to U.S. District Judge Leonard Sand in his ruling yesterday in rejecting the players' racketeering claims, he said, quote, it remains unclear whether the direct cause of the plaintiff's injuries was the decision by the U.S. Attorney's Office to temporarily shut down the Full Tilt Poker website and seize the company's assets, or was instead, as plaintiff's conversion allegations suggest, the subsequent decision by one or more of the defendants to halt player withdrawals. He seems to be saying in that ruling that this might not be the fault of the Full Tilt people, this might be the fault of the DOJ's Black Friday actions that is keeping people from getting their money back. But if that were the case, how come PokerStars paid back every penny that they owed to their players?
I agree with you. It doesn't hold water with me. There's plenty of blame to go around. I don't like the way the DOJ handled it. I don't like the fact that they've not found a way to pay the players back out of the money that's been seized, at least a portion of it or something like that. I think there's plenty of blame to go around. But the fact remains, a site was able to pay back every penny owed to every U.S. players with no problem.
Right.
And there should be regulations and laws in place to ensure that when you play poker online, your money is safe and not at risk. And that's what we've wanted for years. That's what the DOJ should be doing. That's what they should have done a couple of years ago. I still put a lot of the blame right back on their shoulders for the inaction of Washington during this time.
Absolutely. But you have to draw a difference here, a line of difference between Full Tilt and PokerStars. PokerStars did it right. The players got paid back. And while Stars is not in the U.S., it is thriving elsewhere in the world. Full Tilt Poker did it wrong. Their players did not get the money back, and they are not thriving outside of the U.S., and I don't think that you can have a judge here saying, well, this might have been the DOJ's fault that players aren't getting their money back. No, the fault goes right back to the management of Full Tilt Poker and the greedy managers and directors of that company who paid themselves first out of player funds. I think that is still the scandal of Full Tilt.
Yeah, there's no justification for not being able to pay the players back. There's tens of thousands of people that trusted Full Tilt to be able to play on there and that their money was secure, and it's not. So find out why and get them their money back.
I agree. All right, now, while we're talking about Full Tilt, Full Tilt used to be a sponsor of the Aussie Millions, a huge event that goes down every year in Melbourne and which has just finished up. And there were a whole bunch of Full Tilt pros down there. Before I talk about individual results here, names like Gus Hansen and Tom Dwan and Eric Seidel and John Juwanda and Phil Ivey, they were all down at the Aussie Millions. Now, earlier this month, you were at the PCA, which, of course, is a PokerStars event. Were there a lot of Full Tilt pros there, Dennis?
No, actually, it was noticeable by their absence. There were only a couple down there. Eric Seidel is down there, and by the way, just for clarification, Eric Seidel has no reason not to hold his head up high. To my knowledge, and I would be so shocked if it was the case, Eric has done absolutely nothing wrong, had nothing to do with any decision. He happened to be wearing a Full Tilt brand, and that's it. So Eric is clear of everything, to my knowledge, and I would be shocked if there's anything different. But Eric was down there, and he was about the only one. I think Jennifer Harmon showed up down there. And none of the others, no Gus Hansen, no Phil Ivey, no Tom Durr, none of these guys.
Well, they all did show up down in Melbourne, and Phil Ivey got knocked out of the main event in 12th place, winning $100,000 for 12th place in a huge field down there. Then he took that $100K, slapped another $150 on top of it, and entered the Aussie Millions $250,000 challenge. That's their version of the super high roller. And all those guys that we just mentioned, along with Jason Mercier and Daniel Negreanu and about 10 others, including two or three rich businessmen, 16 players in total were involved in this super high roller $250K buy-in. And in the end, Phil Ivey won it, taking down $2 million, beating Patrick Antonius, who won $1.2 million for second place. Ivy wanted heads up against him. Now, when that news came out over the weekend, I got an email from a listener of ours named Jack, who said, considering that Ivy sat out last year's World Series of Poker, not just the main event, but the entire WSOP, because Full Tilt players hadn't been paid back, and they still hadn't, what do you think about him playing in events like this one at the Aussie Millions? What do you say, Dennis?
Well, I'm kind of glad I'm not in Phil Ivey's shoes right now. Of course, he came out and threatened to sue Full Tilt and all sorts of different things. We still don't know exactly, what his compensation was. We don't know a lot of things yet. Phil Ivey, whether you like what he's done or not, is good for poker. He's still a face of it. People still enjoy watching him. He still draws a crowd to the table. I would guarantee when he's playing in the main event, there were more people watching it because he was there than there would have been had he not been. So hopefully things will come out and Phil will get them resolved to everybody's satisfaction and we'll come out of this okay. But I have to admit, Phil Ivey is still good for poker.
I have no problem with Ivy playing in these sort of things. I thought when he said last summer that he wouldn't play in the WSOP, that was kind of his gut reacting with disgust to what had happened in the post-Black Friday environment and the fact that Full Tilt Poker, which had employed him up until that point and which he may have been a small owner of, was not able to pay its players back. But unless there's evidence of Phil Ivey being the bad guy in the Full Tilt saga, in much the way we think of Chris Ferguson and Howard Lederer, I don't think poker players look at Ivy and say, how can you be playing in something like this? Now, I guarantee you, you're not going to see Chris Jesus Ferguson or Howard Lederer showing up and playing in the Aussie Millions. They were both there a year ago. They were not this year, and you will not see them playing in that or any other public poker venue, perhaps ever again. But for Phil Ivey and John Juwanda and the rest of the Full Tilt pros that we mentioned, that's what they do. They didn't own the site. Again, it may have been small percentages for using their name and likenesses and representing the site. But they were not the guys who were running it. They were not the board of directors. They were not the ones deciding to pay themselves out of player funds. So to say to them, you shouldn't be playing in any of these tournaments anywhere in the world, I can see where you might think to yourself, well, the money that they're playing with, they got paid with, wasn't really theirs, and they shouldn't have had it in the first place. I can see that argument, but I don't buy the whole argument about he shouldn't be playing at all. What do you say?
I agree with you completely. Again, I think Phil Ivey is good for poker. I think he's a good player. I think he's a good guy. And I encourage him to play and to play in the U.S. too. I have no problem sitting down with Phil Ivey across the table other than the fact that he'll probably take my chips. But, you know, other than that, I don't have a problem with it. And I hope he's, you know, he got his feet wet in Australia, and hopefully he'll be here this summer for the WSOP, and we'll continue on. Now then, when the finances come out, when we find out how much all these players were paid and everything like that, you know, we'll see what might be the proper thing to do. But you're absolutely right. I guarantee that John Juwanda and Eric Seidel and Phil Ivey and all these other guys, Jennifer Harmon, were not the ones sitting around the table making up policy, deciding who to pay and what checks to write, and watching a bank accounts dwindle and so that the fund was not there to cover the players' deposits. They were not the people doing that. So, you know, let's go. Move forward, as they say.
I agree. Just one other last thing I want to mention about this. You buy in for $250,000 and you win $2 million. That $2 million sounds like a really good number, but would you play in a tournament where when you bought in, you only had a chance of winning eight times your buy-in? I mean, even if you were playing in a $60 tournament here at Harrah's, if first place was only going to be $480, is it worth the time to invest in that?
Well, it depends on your perspective of it. Look at it this way. All he had to beat was 15 other people.
Yeah.
To win at $1.75 million to beat 15 people. Now, it depends on how you look at it. Is it half full or half empty? So, you know, the higher stakes ones, Eric Seidel plays them all the time and loves them because you know you're playing against quality players for the most part, and you know if you cash, it may only be two, three, four, five times what you bought in for. But that's still two, three, four, five times a six-figure buy-in.
That's right. That's absolutely right. All right, let's take a break, and then we'll come back with more of the Final Table Poker Radio Show. Dennis Phillips is in Las Vegas. I'm Paul Harrah's in the World Series of Poker Room here at Harrah's St. Louis. We're hosting our circuit event April 12th through 23rd. It'll be 12 days, 12 rings going on here, and lots of stuff between now and then. In the month of February, they're going to start new bounty tournaments on Tuesdays, $100 buy-in with a $25 bounty for everybody you knock out. You get 10K in starting chips and 20-minute blinds. That'll be every Tuesday at 7 o'clock in February, except for the 14th, which is Valentine's Day, when they're going to be doing their Jack and Jill tournament. A team of a man and a woman buy in for $100 each, and then you alternate in the seat. The man plays for a half hour, the woman plays for a half hour, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the Jack and Jill tournament that was so popular during the Gateway Poker Classic will return for Valentine's Day here. Also coming up on the weekend of February 18th and 19th, the third weekend of the month, those double shootout qualifiers for the WSOP main event in Las Vegas this summer. This is how Dennis went on to become a poker millionaire. You can follow in his shoes if you can get to the final table like he did. First, you got to beat your table here and then the final table here in the double shootout format. $200 buy-in could get you that 10K seat into the Vegas event. That's on the third weekend of February. And then on Saturday, the 25th of February, they'll be doing a $150 buy-in double shootout for the circuit event, main event, coming up here in April. So there's lots of stuff going on. If you want details on all of this, go to harrahsstlouis.com. That's harrahsstlouis.com. This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show, live every Tuesday afternoon at 3 on 590 The Fan KFNS and KFNS.com. This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show. Live from the World Series of Poker Room at Harrah's St. Louis, I am Paul Harris. My partner Dennis Phillips is in Las Vegas. Today we finish up 3 years on the air. This is show number 156. Next year we roll into year number 4. We're glad to have you with us. You can also follow us on Twitter. Dennis_Phillips and Paul Harris Show are our Twitter handles. All right, continuing to talk about some things in the poker news of the past week. There's something going on out in Vegas, Dennis. I don't even know if you're aware of this. There are some poker rooms out there now offering live rake back. This is going on at the Tropicana, which has the new Jamie Gold poker room, and at the Palms with this little six-table room, and Treasure Island, where I think they have 8, maybe 10 tables, and the Wynn, which has, I think they got a couple dozen tables at the Wynn. They're offering live rake back to players there. Have you heard about this?
A little bit about it. Yeah, I think the Wynn's got 25 tables out there. I'm assuming this is a short-term promotion. The Tropicana opening up the Jamie Gold room and expanding their room and trying to become known as a poker-playing casino. Using this, I think, somewhat to get more players down there and to make them, so that they can fill the tables and such. The Palms was trying to expand theirs. I mean, they were hosting the Epic Poker League and doing some things there. So I know they were coming up with some new promotions. It's something new. It's something I don't know a whole lot about. And to be quite honest, something I don't think will be anything long term. If my understanding is correct, I mean, about half of the take from the poker room can go back to the players if they aren't careful. That's a ton of money that's going to be going back to them. I'm not sure how the rooms can justify it and can support it. I mean, it's good for the grinders, but, I guess it remains to be seen.
Well,
I've not experienced it at all.
I wonder, they're paying these people up to $10 an hour to play. So, you play for 60 hours in the course of a week, you could get paid back $600 for a low-limit grinder. You know, that might be more than your regular weekly take would be if you're playing in a 3-6 limit game or a 1-2 no-limit game. I would worry a little bit that the people who would sit there and play for that long might be people who are just going to be kind of rocks at the table and aren't going to be playing a lot of hands. They're going to fold and fold and fold, knowing that even if they don't get involved in hands, you know, the blinds are $1 and $2, so it's not going to cost them all that much. And they're going to get paid back $10 in the course of the hour, which might cover the cost of the blinds that they're losing. And so they're really minimizing their losses, and they're just going to be sitting there folding and waiting for premium hands. I think those are going to be terrible tables to play at, if that's the case.
Well, and you may be absolutely right. That's why I think this actually would fit in better with a time rake rather than a hand rake. And if they do a time rake, then the casino's going to be guaranteed to still be in the black. I mean, if they're paying them back $10 an hour, but the time rake's going to be, you know, $8 every half hour or something like that, you know, then they know they're going to be covered. I've never heard of this until just the last couple of days. And I don't know a whole lot about it. I think it's just a promotional gimmick, such as, you know, a lot of the different casinos out here have done, especially to get some of the local people playing there. Stations offering special rates to the locals when they come in there, and special compensation for meals and bonus points on their comps and things like that. This may be nothing more than that. And I would guess that these are probably short terms, maybe 30-day promotions or something like that? Or do you know, is there any casino in Vegas that's doing this, you know, for as long as it could be? I mean, no end in sight? Are they going to try and make out a policy of the casino?
I don't know. And I would also wonder whether the money is coming out of the regular drop, or if they have a bad beat jackpot in the room, is the money coming out of that jackpot? Or where is it going? You know, a lot of places say, well, we return all of that money to the players. That doesn't mean that it goes all into a jackpot for the players. It could be being done in other ways. I know some rooms that splash pots we're going to throw $100 into a pot at a random table, or they'll use money out of the Bad Beat jackpot to buy buy-ins for main events of their local tournaments or whatever it is. So it's entirely possible that it's coming out of that. That still is coming out of a drop at the table, but you got the rake and you got the Bad Beat drop, which are two different things. All of it is player money that's going in there. And so having that money going back to the players is a good thing. But if the Bad Beat numbers are coming down and this is going up, I think you're really just benefiting the really tight grinders.
Yeah. Now then, if this is coming out of a marketing fund, if this is promotion of some sort and it's not players' money, then I can see no disadvantage for the players.
Right.
It's a little extra bonus. It's like adding money to a tournament or something like that, which people are doing now. So maybe it is promotional money. Maybe it is out of a marketing budget. Maybe they are doing it just to attract new players down there and to show them that they're really willing to go the extra step and the extra mile to benefit and reward the players, the people that play there day in, day out.
If
that's the case, hey, great. I'm all for it.
If it is the case, there's no way it's long term. But I will say this. I mean, played in a lot of poker rooms where the comps are given to you at the rate of about 75 cents or maybe a dollar an hour. $8, $9, $10 an hour is not a bad return.
No, it's not bad at all. And I'll tell you what, it may be nothing more than a moral victory. You go down there and you play for 8 hours, and maybe you lose $400 or $500, but when you walk up there to cash in, they say, oh, and by the way, here's the $80 for playing. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
That would encourage you to come back. That would be a good promotion. That would be a way to make you feel a little better when you left the room.
All right. A couple of other stories in the news this week. The New York Post had a story about Alan Meltzer, who was the record company executive who went out to Vegas and played in some high-stakes games and, in fact, showed up on high-stakes poker two or three times. You may remember him as the short, very round man who looked like he was always just having a really good time being there. And everybody said really nice things about him when he died a few months ago. Two guys who are saying really nice things about him now are his former chauffeur, Jean Laborde, and his former doorman, Shamil Demirage, who were named in Alan Meltzer's will to the tune of $1 million and $500,000 each. That's nice to leave that kind of money behind to some of your employees. The chauffeur said, I loved Alan. He was always joking. He never looked down on anybody. He was such a nice guy. Yes, he left me money, but it's not a good deal for me because it means he's no longer here.
Ooh, cool. That's a heck of a thing to say.
Yeah.
All right.
Also in the news, there's a new class at MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, about online poker. Now, being at MIT, they're looking at it from the math standpoint. You know, they teach things about the strategies and the game theory and all of that stuff. But in the course, which is being taught by Will Ma, who's a guy who has almost $2 million in online tournament earnings himself, one of the things that they have to do in this course, Dennis, is build a poker bot. They play online. They play online on PokerStars' home game format with just play money in the United States. Of course, they can't play for real money, but they play in a home game league on the PokerStars.net site. But one of the things that they've been assigned to do is compete in the MIT Poker Bots competition. Teams of 1 to 4 students will have to put together a completely autonomous poker bot to compete against other teams with more than $30,000 in prizes up for grabs. Now, you're the online player on this show. I'm not.
No,
I'm a live
no,
cash
no.
game player. And I got to yeah. ask you how you feel about the geniuses at MIT trying to build better poker bots.
This to me, just sounds horrible. I would have to see some sort of justification for it. For example, on PokerStars, it is illegal to use a bot. If they find you using a bot, they will confiscate your account and kick you off the site. That's how strongly they feel about it. I don't want to sit down at a table and play against a couple of computers. It would bother me. I would be upset with it. I know that the security, again, I can only speak for PokerStars, but I know there's other sites the same way. They spend hours and hours trying to find these bots. They do everything they can to prohibit them from playing on there. Why do we want some of the smartest people in the world trying to build better bots?
give me a break. Let's find a way to hack into the Pentagon while we're at it. I want a course there for that. Stealing identities as done by MIT students. Here we go. What the heck, guys?
Well, all of that, of course, is illegal. If they're building these poker bots, they only become illegal once they put them in play on sites that ban them. But maybe this is kind of like the MIT blackjack teams that people like Andy Block and others were part of. You know, they're smart enough to figure out a better way and a better system to beat the system. What's wrong with that?
Because, unfortunately, they're earning college credits to find out a way to beat the system. And I don't want them spending their time, energy, and resources trying to find out ways to screw with the actual site.
Yeah.
That to me, that's just horrible.
It
literally is paying somebody to have fun breaking into the Pentagon. That just bothers me.
What does this do to the credibility of online poker going forward if these guys are successful?
Well, again, it's just like hackers. There's a constant war between sites and between the hacking as to who can come up with the best way. And every time they come up with a new worm or a new whatever the heck it is, virus of some sort, then they've got to counter it and come back against them. If you're building better bots, it just means they're going to have to get better security, which means they're going to build better bots, which means they're going to build better security. It's a never-ending war. Why do you want to encourage it and have some of the smartest people in the country do it on what sounds almost like a lark? No, I just totally disagree with that.
Okay, so we'll cancel Dennis's application to MIT right now. Just cross that right
Not
out.
Not like they would accept me.
Lastly, on the show today, we get emails from people all the time asking strategy questions, and we really haven't had a chance to get into this. Before I get to any emails, though, I want to talk about a hand that I observed when I was out there playing live at the bike at the Bicycle Casino in California a couple of weeks ago. I played in the game for a while and then went in the booth with Bart Hansen and David Tuckman, the two guys who announced that. And if you've never watched it, by the way, you can watch it online Tuesdays and Friday nights. It's a live cash game. Most of the time you're not going to know any of the players, but Bart and Dave do a great job of analysis of the hands, and they really get deep into strategy about some of the hands. And this is one of the hands that came up while I was in the booth, and I'm curious about how you feel about it. There was a 5-10 game, and one of the players had about $1,000 in front of him and raised under the gun to 40. Again, 5-10 game, so 40, a fairly standard raise. Another player calls in middle position and the cutoff calls. Now, the guy who raised under the gun had ace-5 off suit. He's just kind of trying to make a move here. Weird to be raising with that hand under the gun at a table like this, but he did anyway. And the guy in middle position who called had just a pair of tens. And I say just a pair of tens because that seems like a weird hand to just flat with. I don't remember what the guy on the button had, but when the flop came out, it was 3-3-3. Now, the under-the-gun player bets 100 into a pot of about 135, and the guy with tens raises to 400. The button instantly folds, and the under-the-gun guy with ace-5 instantly folds. That led to a bit of analysis by Bart, who said that the guy with tens made a big mistake there. I'm curious what you think of the way the hand was played and about that strategy of raising in that situation on a 3-3-3 flop when you've got a pair of tens and position on the guy who raised pre-flop.
Well, again, you're analyzing a hand where I don't know the players, I don't know how they play. I mean, is the guy under the gun raising 30-40% of the time, where he's raising a very weak hand?
They're both relatively new to the table. All I remember is that the guy who was under the gun started the hand with about $1,000. The other guy had about $2,500 behind, but they both were fairly new to the table. They'd only been there for a round or two.
Okay. Again, raising under the gun with an ace-5, it's a hand that they aren't going to probably put you on, and you have position to, quote, first bluff, too, afterwards, probably. So I've raised with some oddball hands. I raised down the PCA main event with a 9-10 offsuit under the gun. You know, you can do it. But
just the smooth call with a 10-10, I really question that. I guarantee, because what happens if an ace, a king, a queen, a jack, or whatever flops out there? What are you going to do if the guy makes a continuation bet? You're going to try and steal it from him then or something? I don't know. I don't agree with this pre-flop play. And I have no idea what the other guy with the 40 did, but he could have had a wide range of hand. He had position behind these others. Who knows about that, but who cares at this time?
Right.
But the 3-3-3, see, he did Bart think that he should have tried to maximize his return on this even more?
Well,
Is that what his goal was?
When the original raiser continued, Bart thought that the guy with 10s should just call there because that way you might get another bluff out of the guy on the turn.
I disagree.
I talked later to the guy with the 10s, and he said, what do I do if an overcard peels off there and he bets again?
Exactly. Not only that, but you also have a player to your left. If you just smooth call again, or smooth called 100, and this guy behind you makes it 250, what do you do?
Yep.
Now he's got position on you, and he's raising you with a 3-3-3 board. No. I would not smooth call pre-flop. I would not smooth call after the flop. I want to find out where I'm at. Because if I raise it to 400 there, and one of these two guys then are probably going to either shove or fold, and you know where you're at. You figure you're probably good, but that's a dangerous, dangerous situation to be in.
But the thing is, you're never getting called by a weaker hand in that situation. Five, six, sevens, eights, they're all folding. And if the guy does have an overpair to your tens, he's going to get it all in, and you've now lost that $400.
Okay. If you just smooth call, and the guy behind you makes it 200, and then the guy back there calls the 200, then you're obligated with another 100, and then the jack peels off. Now, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
I would much rather find out where I'm at, even if it costs me that extra 300. You're not folding, obviously.
Yep.
There's no way you're folding.
Yep.
So, you know, the 100's in the pot, period, minimum. I'd rather find out where I'm at. And he made it enough of a raise that he's committing these other two. Now, if he only raised it to 2.25, then, you know, you're not for sure where you're at. You know, if somebody just smooth calls you. I actually don't mind the 400. I think he could have got by with raising it to about 3.25 and saved a few dollars and got the same result. So I think he overbetted a little bit. But I don't mind the raise there at all.
All right. If you've got a strategy question, send it to DennisPhillipsPoker@gmail.com, and we'll get to it on a future show. Dennis is in Las Vegas. I'm Paul Harris at the World Series of Poker Room at Harrah's St. Louis. Join us next Tuesday at 3 for another round of the Final Table Poker Radio Show. Catch us on iTunes or Stitcher Radio or here on 590 The Fan KFNS and KFNS.com.